You're listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, go to nakedbiblepodcast.com and click on the support link in the upper right-hand corner. If you're new to the podcast and Dr. Heiser's approach to the Bible, click on New Start Here at nakedbiblepodcast.com.
Welcome to the Naked Bible Podcast, episode 168, Melchizedek, part 2. I'm the layman, Trey Strickland, and he's the scholar, Dr. Michael Heiser. Hey, Mike. I feel like we need a better intro. Like, I need to say, like, here's Dr. Michael Heiser, you know, and then have like a, laugh track or clapping track, you know, like they do people, you know.
I hope you're not recording this.
I am recording this. Yes.
No, we're not going to do something dumb like that.
Why?
Yeah. Whatever possessed you, you know, to think about that.
Possession might be the right word. I don't know. Are we really going to include?
I'm thinking it is, you know.
All right, Mike. Well, what's going on? You're going to be going on coast to coast.
Yeah. We should mention that. I'm scheduled to be on coast to coast AM, what is for me the evening of July 24th. I'm actually going to be slated to go on at midnight and then midnight till 2. Then again, those are Pacific times. So if you are on the East Coast, I mean, you can do the math. It's 3 hours different unless they do something to air coast to coast differently. I don't know, but it'll be the evening of the 24th. Again, Pacific time, I go on at midnight, and I'm saying evening because, you know, it's for me, it would be the evening of the 24th for 2 hours. So the topic is going to be the Book of Enoch, you know, reversing Hermon stuff. So if anybody wants to listen to Coast to Coast AM for that, that's when it's scheduled.
All right, that sounds good. And real quick, don't forget to send me questions about Melchizedek after all the Melchizedek episodes are out, because we're going to be doing a Q&A over Melchizedek specifically. So the cutoff again is August 14th. So, all right, Mike, well, we're out of the Old Testament into some new literature.
Second Temple period. Yeah, yep. Yeah. Second Temple period again. And both the Old Testament stuff and then this episode today are going to be the necessary backdrop for the New Testament material. We're going to drift into New Testament a little bit today, like we sort of did a little bit earlier on talking about the Old Testament. But we're going to be talking about some things today that I think listeners will, you know, sort of it'll perk up your ears, because some of this stuff is going to sound New Testament-y more than even the Old Testament stuff. But for by way of a summary, I guess, a little bit of a recap with the Old Testament stuff, some of the sort of summary statements that we had for that material, I'm just going to try to re-summarize here, and then we'll jump into Second Temple literature again. And for those who may not be familiar with that term, Second Temple literature, Second Temple period, is what we more popularly refer to as the intertestamental period. So that period between Old Testament history and the beginning of the New Testament. There's lots of stuff going on there, lots of stuff being written, and there's some of that devoted to Melchizedek. So by way of, again, summarizing where we've been, we have Melchizedek. Again, his name could either be something, you know, some sort of description, you know, my king is righteous, or it could be a theophoric name, my king is Tzedek. We talked a lot about that. We have this guy with a title, the King of Salem or Solomon, and he was associated with some really important themes: kingship, obviously, priesthood. Again, those are the two most apparent, but also Jerusalem. He was the King of Solomon. We talked about how that's Jerusalem. Even if his name is theophoric, Tzedek, who would be Yahweh in Israelite religion anyway, he is still associated with righteousness and peace because of the Tzedek term and the Salem term in those either proper names or topographic name, you know, place name. At no point in the Old Testament material, any of it, was there any sense that Melchizedek was more than a man. We never ran into anything that would indicate that people thought, or he was portrayed, is probably a better way to say it, in the Old Testament as a divine being. He just isn't. So he, you know, when we look at him, the, you know, how we need to sort of focus on him, at least to this point, is just as a human being. He is the chief, royal, and priestly representative of the Most High God. That's who he is in the Old Testament. The divinity aspect of Melchizedek is something that's going to begin in what we cover today in the Second Temple period. Now, you know, since he is, I mean, think of it abstractly, since he is the chief royal and priestly representative of the Most High God, and that, think about the wording there. He's associated with kingship and priesthood. He's focused in, you know, Jerusalem, all these things. Those items, those terms, and the motifs, the symbols, all the baggage, you know, the theological baggage that goes with that priesthood and kingship, that's invariably going to get linked to Messiah, to a messianic figure, a deliverer figure. And once you're into messianic territory, then you start to be thinking a bit more, again, abstractly, theologically. The way you think about those things is going to sort of transcend normative time and place for a number of Jews. And so it's not an abnormal thing that people would be thinking of Melchizedek as some sort of divine figure later on, because, again, well, if he's really the representative of the Most High God, then, you know, maybe God is, you know, is going to, you know, be behind this person in a special way, or is going to send him in a special way. And as people are speculating on who the Messiah is going to be and what's the Messiah going to be like, and they're, you know, if you've read Unseen Realm, this is going to be familiar to you, but if we're thinking about the covenants and certain scenes in the Old Testament that involve the second Yahweh figure, the visible form of Yahweh as a man, the angel of the Lord, and how that terminology and certain episodes in which the angel plays an important part, how those sort of overlap with, again, important themes of covenant and kingship and even priesthood and, you know, fighting Yahweh's battles, all these things. Again, I use the phrase a lot, matrix of ideas, and that's what we're dealing with here. And Melchizedek becomes part of this matrix of ideas, and since that matrix contains not just kingship and priesthood, but also, again, this figure of the second Yahweh at some point, you know, again, depending on what passage you're in, all of those things get thrown into the blender. And so when Jews in the Second Temple period look at all that, they look at the whole matrix, all these passages that are interconnected and the ideas that go along with them. There's going to be a few of those Jews that start thinking about the Messiah in divine terms. And since, again, Melchizedek is connected to the Davidic dynasty that would produce the Messiah, a la Psalm 110, they're going to be thinking about Melchizedek as a divine being too, that maybe he is prototypical or a type of the Messiah. He's a prefigurement of the Messiah. And once you start thinking those thoughts, it opens the door to viewing Melchizedek as more than just a normal guy. And that's what's going to happen. Now, we also talked about in the Old Testament how the priesthood of Aaron was essentially a concession by God, plan B, if you will, in response to Moses' unbelief. Again, that is not something we're necessarily going to return to until we get to the New Testament, when the priesthood of Melchizedek is compared to the Aaronic priesthood. That's something we'll return to, not so much today, but in our New Testament episode, we will. And that's the mix that we're dealing with. Again, Melchizedek is linked to Abraham, is linked to Abraham's seed, is linked to Elyon, the Most High, is linked to Deuteronomy 32, which is linked to the divorce of the nations, which is, of course, linked to the reclaiming of those nations through the Abrahamic covenant. The Abrahamic covenant would produce a seed, which, of course, takes us to David, again, the Davidic dynasty. And, of course, Melchizedek is a priest. And once we start talking about you know, the priesthood of Melchizedek being elevated or considered, you know, more ideal than the priesthood of Aaron, you know, you throw all that into the hopper, and this is, again, the matrix of ideas that we're dealing with. The evidence in the text is that Melchizedek's kingship is connected to Abraham. It legitimizes the rule of Abraham's seed. And, of course, the original Edenic king, Adam, was ruler and mediator. He was king and priest in a very broad, you know, theological sense on earth, because, you know, he was the guy that sort of stood between God and the rest of humanity, the rest of what would be his descendants. And he was, again, put there in Eden to be a steward king, you know, a ruler of the earth in a positive sense. That all continues through the patriarchs up to Moses, and Moses, it divides because of his unbelief. You know, we God makes a concession and brings the priesthood of Aaron into the picture. It would seem reasonable to think, again, that having both those offices operate in one person was God's ideal, because that, again, harkens back to Adam, and that is God's consistent plan. You know, God is meeting with a person, a patriarch, and that patriarch is the go-between between God and the rest of the people in the picture, the rest of the people that are concerned. But that breaks apart when we get to Moses again. So the ideal, you know, would have been to have them both in one. And since this Melchizedek figure is the oldest, you know, figure, you know, it sort of continues that the patriarchal idea better than Moses did. He gets referenced in Psalm 110 and connected to David's line and ultimately the Messiah. So you have to be thinking about all these things sort of at once and how they touch each other to make sense of what. Of how Melchizedek is portrayed in the Old Testament, and even more importantly, how he's thought about once these ideas, again, are all in the blender. And that brings us to the Second Temple period. So today, we want to get into the literature here, and you know, we're gonna end up focusing mostly on Dead Sea Scroll material, but we'll hit a few other things. Melchizedek is mentioned in a number of Second Temple works. Again, works, or at least works that scholars figure date back into the Second Temple period. I say it that way because of issues with books like Second Enoch. Now, I have no idea if any of you have a dictionary of New Testament background. I have no idea why DNTB has Second Enoch as, quote, the earliest instance in the Second Temple literature of a mention of Melchizedek, because the text just doesn't date itself into the Second Temple period. But I thought I'd throw that out in case one of you has that resource. It might just sound odd, because it honestly does sound odd. The manuscript evidence for Second Enoch is Slavonic, which is the 14th century. And if you look at Charlesworth, Old Testament Pseudepigrapha volume, where he talks about Second Enoch, it'd be volume one. The guy who wrote the chapter on Second Enoch is Francis Anderson. And Anderson suggests a Greek work, you know, that Second Enoch was a Greek work no older than 1000 AD, which is well after the Second Temple period. Nevertheless, you know, everybody figures, hey, you know, it's Enochian material. There's a lot of that stuff that's really old. So Second Enoch kind of becomes part of the picture here. We're not going to, because of the textual issue, the manuscript issue, I'll admit, again, that Second Enoch has things in it that are probably as old as the Second Temple period, because hey, that's where First Enoch is, and there's going to be overlap there. But I'm not going to spend really any time on Second Enoch here. I'm going to go right to sources whose manuscript evidence place them firmly in the Second Temple period. So let's start with Josephus. Melchizedek is mentioned in Josephus's sixth volume of his book about the Wars of the Jews. And in my edition, it would be lines 435 to 438. I think the line numbering is pretty consistent. But I'm just going to read you the passage. So this is from Josephus, the Jewish Wars, Volume 6, beginning in line 435. He writes, "And thus was Jerusalem taken in the second year of the reign of Vespasian, on the eighth day of the month, Gorpaeus, which is Elul. It had been taken five times before, though this was the second time of its desolation. For Shishak, the king of Egypt, and after him Antiochus, and after him Pompey, and after them Sosius and Herod took the city, but still preserved it. But before all these, the king of Babylon conquered it and made it desolate." Of course, there's the reference to Nebuchadnezzar. 1,468 years and 6 months after it was built. But he who first built it was a potent man among the Canaanites, and is on our tongue called Melchizedek, the righteous king, for such he really was, on which account he was there the first priest of God, and first built a temple there, and called the city Jerusalem, which was formerly called Salem. Now that is, you know, the excerpt from Josephus where he mentions Melchizedek. And obviously, and kind of interestingly, Melchizedek is considered the person who built the first temple. And you say, well, that's kind of odd, because I thought Solomon built the first temple in Jerusalem. Well, he built the first Israelite temple, Josephus would say. But Josephus is thinking, well, there was a temple there because Melchizedek was priest of the Most High, you know, Most High God, and you know, there had to be a temple there. And so he credits all that to Melchizedek. He credits Melchizedek with building the city. Again, the Old Testament doesn't say any of that stuff, but you know, that's what That's what Josephus is thinking. And again, he's likely not alone. But notice, even despite all of that embellishment, Melchizedek is considered a historical human. There's no hint in what we just read that he's thought of as a divine being by Josephus. So here's a clear Second Temple period example where Melchizedek is mentioned, talked about. Again, some things are added to the Old Testament, but he's not a divine person, not a divine being. Now, if we go to Philo, again, Philo was another really important writer in this period. Philo found room both for a sort of literal historical interpretation of Melchizedek as a human being and a sort of more than literal interpretation of Melchizedek as the Logos. And of course, Logos is the term in John 1, you know, for the Word of God. You know, Jesus, of course, was the Word. And if you've read Unseen Realm, you know that that thinking is not just from Philo or from some Platonic this and that. You have Word of the Lord being the visible human Yahweh in the Old Testament. And you have even more of those instances if you read the Targums, you know, the Aramaic translations of the Old Testament. So there's a lot of evidence. It doesn't force you to go out to Greco-Roman philosophy, which is, you know, what Philo was working in a lot to get a Logos doctrine. You don't need that stuff. But Philo certainly has his head in that. And for him, Melchizedek gets sort of parsed as the Logos, you know, as a divine figure. Now, I'm going to read an excerpt here from DDD by Reiling, R-E-I-L-I-N-G. And he has an entry on Melchizedek, and he goes into the Philo material a little bit. And I kind of like his summary. It's pretty convenient here. So he writes, Philo mentions Melchizedek in three places. We have, if I can get the abbreviations correctly here, I always, you know, kind of mess up the abbreviations in Philo. On Abraham, and then we have the book that is referred to as Preliminary Studies, at least by scholars. And then thirdly, the Allegorical Interpretation, Volume 3. Those are the three works of Philo where Melchizedek is mentioned. So continuing with Reiling, he says, in the Abraham book, again, On Abraham, in On Abraham 235, the story of Genesis 14, 18 through 20 is retold and embellished. Melchizedek is called the great priest of the Most High God. Thinking that Abraham's success was due to divine wisdom and help, he stretched his hands to heaven and honored him with prayers and offered sacrifices on his behalf and entertained him and his men lavishly. In the subsequent allegorical interpretation of the story of Abraham's warfare, that is Genesis 14, 1 through 24, Melchizedek is not mentioned again by Philo. He acts as a historical person only. In Preliminary Studies 99, Melchizedek is mentioned in an excursus on the number 10. Those are lines 89 through 120 in that book of Philo, Preliminary Studies, with reference to the fact that Abraham gave him one-tenth of everything. That's Genesis 14:20. So I'll just stop here and pause. So for Philo, Philo reads this, you know, that Abraham gives 10% to Melchizedek, and then he goes off on some excursus about the meaning of the number 10. That's the context for him discussing Melchizedek in that particular book. Back to Reiling here. He says, this is interpreted metaphorically, again, this tenth of everything. Everything, quote unquote, comprises the things of sense and speech and thought. Melchizedek is identified as the man who obtained the self-learned and self-taught priesthood, probably because no priest is mentioned before him in the Bible, and later priesthood is not derived from him. In Allegorical Interpretation, Volume 3, this is 79 through 82, Melchizedek is presented as an example of people who are honored by God without having done beforehand something to please him. It's kind of interesting. He was made king by God, and he was the first to be worthy to be his priest. In Philo's perspective, catch this, this is Reiling, again, writing about this. In Philo's perspective, Melchizedek, as a king and priest, does not cease to be a historical person, but at the same time serves as the embodiment of the divine Logos and transcends history. And you say, well, that's the end of the quote. You say, well, how does that work? You know, I'm trying to follow Philo's thinking here. What in the world is he? You know, look, your guess is as good as anybody else's. Philo's writing, this is what it's like. Philo will go off on these riffs of allegorical interpretation, speculation about the meaning of numbers and things like this. And you just wonder, what set him off? You know, what put him on that path? What suggested these things to him? And again, the honest answer is sometimes you can sort of figure that out because of the mass of material he might be discussing at some other place. But other times it's just really dense and obtuse. And honestly, even specialists in phyla have no idea why, you know, he went in you know, this or that direction. So it's a little bit up in the air. Again, sometimes Philo, his thinking is discernible. You can track with him and know why he's saying what he's saying. Other times you just can't. But this is where he's at. He associates Melchizedek with the Logos. So he's an important resource in the Second Temple period that is beginning to think about Melchizedek as something not unhistorical, but more than a man. And that's why we want to mention him. Now, third resource, Qumran literature, the Dead Sea Scrolls. And this is where we're going to spend the lion's share of our time because there's a specific text here that's really important. Melchizedek is mentioned twice in the Dead Sea Scrolls. There's the Genesis Apocryphon. That's 1QAP, Genesis, G-E-N, in the 22nd column. In that, you know, just look at the title, Genesis Apocryphon. This is a retelling of the story of Genesis. So naturally, you're going to hit Genesis 14, 18 through 20. And in this Dead Sea Scroll, that passage from the Old Testament is translated more or less literally. There are a few little minor additions to the story, but nothing really, you know, spectacular. Melchizedek is presented pretty straightforwardly as a historical person. And there's no real speculation about his name or, like in Philo's case, about what tenth means and all that. There's none of that. It's just a straightforward translation. This particular Dead Sea Scroll is in Aramaic. So it's put into Aramaic and on we go. We move on, you know, through other material in Genesis. So there isn't that much that's added that would be sort of speculative, which is quite different, you know, than Philo and quite different from, you know, from other texts as well. Now, the big one, the big deal for Second Temple literature, and I had to go through this text a lot, you know, for my dissertation, is something called 11Q Melchizedek, also known as 11Q13. As the title suggests, this is from Cave 11. That's what the numbers are for, 11Q, 11 Qumran. It's Qumran Cave 11. And it gets its name, Melchizedek, because of the content. 13 would refer to the number of the manuscripts. These are all fragmentary, but column 2, it's still fragmentary, but column 2 has a lot of content in it. And since column 2 is drawing on Old Testament texts, even when there are some holes that they can be filled in, if they're citing Old Testament verses, you can just go look at what the content was. Now, what I'm going to do is I'm going to read a translation of this text. And when there is an Old Testament verse referenced, I will tell you what the verse is, and then we'll discuss it. I'm going to share, again, some the research of some scholars who specialize on this text and Second Temple literature and New Testament, on the New Testament just generally. But I'm going to read through this text, and the translation is from Garcia Martinez and Tig Kilar, their Dead Sea Scrolls study edition. If you have that, you could follow along. If you can, you know, read Hebrew, there's going to be a couple places here you might want to check the Hebrew. But at any rate, here's what it says. Again, this is column 2, 11Q Melchizedek. I think you're going to find it really interesting. Again, this is pre-New Testament. Pre-New Testament. There's no question about the dating of the manuscript. So line 1 is fragmentary, and it doesn't really, it can't be read. Line 2, we get into text, and it says, "And as for what he said," and then he's going to quote Leviticus 25:13, "in this year of Jubilee, you shall return each one to his respective property. Concerning it, he said," now he's going to quote Deuteronomy 15:2, "this is the manner of the release. Every creditor shall release what he lent to his neighbor. He shall not coerce his neighbor or his brother, for it has been proclaimed a release for God." It's interpretation, okay, Hebrew or Aramaic, you know, Pishro, okay? So I'll just stop there. This is line 4. When you see this Pishro in a text, you can tell right away it's what scholars call midrash, which it's an explanation. It's something, it's sort of like a commentary, even though that it's not like an official. There are commentaries in the Qumran literature that are verse-by-verse commentaries on Old Testament books. This text is going to actually combine a bunch of different verses and then offer commentary on the combination thereof. But it's not verse by verse in one text, but it is nevertheless a commentary. It's an interpretation. So back to line 4. Its interpretation. For the last days refers to captives. So let me just stop there. He's saying, well, here's why I quoted Leviticus 25:13 and Deuteronomy 15:2, this whole thing about Jubilee and returning the property and everything like that. The reason I did that, I'm pretending to be the writer of Melchizedek, is because in the last days refer to captives. Back to the text. Who, and then there's a gap, and whose teachers have been hidden and kept secret, and from the inheritance of Melchizedek. For they are the inheritance of Melchizedek, who will make them return, and liberty will be proclaimed for them, to free them from the debt of all their iniquities. And this will happen in the first week of the Jubilee, which follows the 9 Jubilees. And the Day of Atonement is the end of the 10th Jubilee, in which atonement shall be made for all the sons of light and for the men of the lot of Melchizedek. Over them, and then there's a gap, according to all their works, for it is the time for the year of grace of Melchizedek and of his armies, the nation of the holy ones of God, of the rule of judgment. Now that's the end of line 9. And I'm going to stop there because of something that happens in line 10. But you see, this is Mike talking now, you see what's going on here. He's saying, look, he takes a concept of the Jubilee and slavery, captives. And you can tell already he's thinking that in the end times is something, the latter days is something about the release of the captives. Now, if you're a Jew and you're still under Roman dominion and whatnot, this is something that you expect the Messiah to do. You expect the Messiah to come back and get rid of Rome and release, you make you free, everybody goes back to the land, you restore the Levitical system. But he's also throwing in sort of chronological marks here about the Jubilee and the Day of Atonement. If you remember back to when we discussed this kind of language in relationship to the book of Ezekiel, and even the last episode we did, this, which was the second episode on Ezekiel 40 through 48, we made the comment that over 60 times in Ezekiel 40 through 48, you have Jubilee language. And I made the comment that was not coincidental. And we need to interpret Ezekiel 40 to 48 as something more than a literal temple being rebuilt. We talked about all the problems with that view. But if you look at it as abstractly and connect it with the Jubilee, there were all sorts of ways you could connect Ezekiel 40 through 48 with New Testament talk about the Messiah's body being the temple and how his followers being the temple and associating the Messiah, again, with the Jubilee release. This is what the writer of this text, 11Q Melchizedek, is thinking. He's thinking along the same lines that, connecting the end of days, the last times with this Jubilee release and the Jubilee cycles. And, just to quote him again, we have here the first week of the Jubilee, which follows the 9 Jubilees. The Day of Atonement is the end of the 10th Jubilee. Again, you get these Jubilee year cycles. And so he's associating that with this release. Now, you might be thinking already, well, boy, that passage about setting the captives free, where have I heard that before? Okay, well, you've heard that in Jesus' first sermon when he launches his ministry in Nazareth. He quotes Isaiah 61, again, about the release of the captives, the whole Jubilee concept. It's really interesting that here you have a Jew. This is 100, 200 years, before the New Testament period, thinking about the end of days in terms of a Jubilee year release. And he associates it with Melchizedek for some reason. And we've talked about, in our Old Testament discussions, we've talked about what those reasons might be, because Melchizedek, again, is this ideal king priest. He is tied to the Davidic dynasty from which the Messiah will come, a la Psalm 110. So this guy here is tracking on Melchizedek. I'll read verse 9 again. It is the time for the year of grace of Melchizedek and of his armies. His armies, the nation of the holy ones of God, of the rule of judgment, as it is written. Now, let's go into verse 10. This is going to be kind of mind-blowing here. So he's talking about Melchizedek and his armies, the nation of the holy ones of God. And he's already talked about the sons of light, okay? Now, obviously, their enemies are going to be the sons of the darkness and all that sort of stuff. But here we go. Verse 9 again. It is the time for the year of grace of Melchizedek and of his armies, the nation of the holy ones of God, of the rule of judgment, as it is written about him in the songs of David, who said, and he quotes Psalm 82, verse 1. David, songs of David, who said, Elohim will stand in the assembly of God. In the midst of the gods he judges. And about him he said, now he quotes Psalm 7, 8, and 9, and above it, to the heights, return. God will judge the peoples. As for what he said, Psalm 82 again, verse 2, how long will you judge unjustly and show partiality to the wicked? Its interpretation, Pishro, here's what he thinks it means. Its interpretation concerns Belial, who again is a Satan figure, and the spirits of his lot, who, turning aside from the commandments of God to commit evil. And then there's a gap. Okay. Let's just stop there. The writer of 11Q Melchizedek associates Melchizedek with being God. Okay. Psalm 82:1. The capital G-O-D in Psalm 82:1, he thinks is Melchizedek, who is standing in the assembly of God in the midst of the gods and judging them. I mean, just think about that. You know, if you've read Unseen Realm, you know all about how, you know all about Psalm 82. And you also know all about, you know, the whole two Yahwehs idea, that there were two Yahweh figures in Old Testament thinking. And this is the foundation for the later ancient Jewish doctrine of two powers in heaven, you know, two good guys, two Yahweh figures. And I've mentioned in many cases, and some of you have either seen me lecture on this on YouTube or maybe live at some place, there was lots of speculation in the Second Temple period about who the second Yahweh figure was. Okay, we know in the Old Testament he shows up as a man, he's visible. But who is that? You know, what's his identity? And I've made comment before about some thought he was an exalted Old Testament figure like David, okay, or Abraham or Moses, or in this case, Melchizedek. Melchizedek is one of the two powers candidates that get floated in Jewish writings of the Second Temple period. And it's very clear here. He associates Melchizedek with being the one who is judging the gods in Psalm 82. And again, he associates that with the release of people in bondage to the kind of misery that the gods are inflicting upon them. Now, at this point, you have to suspend what you know a little bit, you know, because some of you are probably thinking, well, he's wrong, because Psalm 82 is about the gods of the nations, and those are Gentiles. It has nothing to do with the release and the Jubilees. And okay, we get that. We're just reading through a text that explains what this particular Jewish writer was thinking. He is associating Melchizedek with the Lord of the Council. And I've done the same thing with Jesus, where in John chapter 10, Jesus quotes Psalm 82. You know, we did a whole episode on that. Again, you get the idea, these sorts of connections, you know, of identifying particular individuals. Again, Christians are going to do this with Jesus, obviously. And again, isn't it a coincidence that Jesus gets compared, analogized to Melchizedek in the New Testament? Again, we'll get there. But there are Jews who were there before. Again, they're thinking of Melchizedek as being more than a man, and they're associating him here, believe it or not, with Psalm 82. Psalm 82, verse 1. And Melchizedek is the leader. You know, remember verse 9, his armies? He's the leader of armies that are going to liberate the peoples of the earth, okay? He's going to liberate them, and he's going to go to war with Belial, the Satan figure, and the spirits of his lot. Now, if you know anything about Dead Sea Scroll stuff, there's a very famous scroll called the War Scroll. It's 1QM, as memory serves. That describes the apocalyptic, you know, end of days battle. And it's a war between gods and men. And on both sides, you have human combatants and divine combatants fighting it out, you know, in heaven and on earth, you know, for basically all the marbles. This is the kind of thing that this text is alluding to, this same idea, you know, where you have this warfare going on. Let's go back to the text now. I'll pick it up in verse 12. So its interpretation, again, this is what he thinks it means, concerns Belial and the spirits of his lot, who, turning aside from the commandments of God to commit evil, and then it just drops off there, line 13. But Melchizedek will carry out the vengeance of God's judgments. And on that day, he will free them from the hand of Belial and from the hand of all the spirits of his lot. To his aid shall come all the gods of justice. And he is the one who, and then there's a gap in the text, all the sons of God, and there's another gap. Isn't that frustrating? I'll read line 14 over again. To his aid shall come all the gods of justice. Isn't that interesting? Gods of justice, gods of Tzedek. Okay, we've talked a lot about Tzedek, with Melchizedek in the prior two episodes, but here we have this line: He shall, to his aid shall come all the gods of Tzedek. In other words, the rest of Yahweh's, heavenly host army is going to come help Melchizedek, win this battle. Line 15: This is the day of peace about which he said. Then there's a gap. Through Isaiah the prophet, who said, now he's going to quote Isaiah 52:7. How beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger who announces peace, the messenger of good who announces salvation, saying to Zion, your God reigns. Pishro, its interpretation. The mountains are the prophets. Before you think that's really odd, just bear with him. He's a Second Temple Jewish guy, and this is what they're thinking. The mountains are the prophets, line 18, and the messenger is the anointed of the Spirit, as Daniel said about him. Now he's going to quote Daniel 9:25. The messenger is the anointed of the Spirit, as Daniel said about him, until an anointed, a prince, it is 7 weeks, unquote. And the messenger of good who announces salvation is the one about whom it is written, to comfort the afflicted. Pishro, its interpretation. That means to instruct them in all the ages of the world. Line 21 has two words, in truth, and then there's nothing. Line 22 is fragmentary. It says, has turned away from Belial and will return. Then it ends. Line 23 says, in the judgments of God as it is written about him, quoting Isaiah 52:7 again, saying to Zion, your God rules. Zion is the congregation of all the sons of justice. Those who establish the covenant, those who avoid walking on the path of the people. And your God, this is the way the text ends, the column ends, your God is Melchizedek, who will free them from the hand of Belial. And as for what he said, quotes Leviticus 25:9, you shall blow the horn in all the land of, and then it breaks off. That's column 2, 11Q Melchizedek. There's a lot of strange stuff in there. And for our purposes, what I want you to store away as we continue in our discussion here is that you very clearly have a Second Temple Jew. When they think about Melchizedek, they are thinking of a divine being. And I would say they're thinking about the second Yahweh figure. This is a candidate who is at the head of the armies of God himself. And this Jew views Melchizedek as being the Elohim who is going to judge the gods over the nations, otherwise known to him as the spirits of Belial, the spirits of Belial's lot, those who are, under the power, under the influence, in league with Satan, essentially. Again, the way scholars, and myself included, again, parse Psalm 82 is a little bit different, and that's fine. Just that 11Q Melchizedek tells you what one guy, one author was thinking. And it's very, very clear that Melchizedek is just more than a man. And he even brings in verses, concepts to talk about Melchizedek in ways that the New Testament writers will talk about Jesus. Okay? Now, Melchizedek is also mentioned. His name is mentioned in 11Q 17. That's really all you get, just the name. There's another fragment, 4Q 401, fragment 11. There's three lines. There's only a few words. It has priests of, and then there's a break, and then gods of knowledge, break. And then line 3, Melchizedek, priest in the assembly of God. Again, it's hearkening back to Psalm 82 again. So that's what you get, with 11Q Melchizedek, otherwise known as 11Q 13. Now, what I want to do at this point is I want to read you some excerpts from a couple of papers. One is published in the Journal for the Study of Judaism in the Persian, Hellenistic, and Roman period. It's by Delcor. The title is Melchizedek from Genesis to the Qumran Texts and the Epistle to the Hebrews. And then a little bit from Jim Davila's SBL seminar paper back in 1996. Delcor's article, by the way, is 1971. But 20-some years later, 1996, Davila gave an SBL paper entitled Melchizedek, Michael, and the War in Heaven. And I want to quote a few things from both of those papers. Okay, we'll start with Delcor, and this is on pages 124 and 125. Again, just reading, you know, his commentary on what we just read. He's talking about 11Q Melchizedek. So he writes, the character Melchizedek appears in an incomplete text of Cave 11 of Qumran, published by Vanderwood. In this fragment, written in Hebrew, Melchizedek appears as an eschatological savior who has a heritage. His mission is to bring back at the end of days the exiles to announce to them their liberation and the expiation of their sins. The fragment here takes up in part Isaiah 61:1, and at least conceptually, which Luke applies to Jesus in Luke 4:18. Melchizedek appears also as a celestial being, Elohim, who stands in the assembly of God and on this occasion will judge the heavenly ones. Okay, in the midst of the gods, he passes judgment. Psalm 82:1. Those are the ones he's judging. Delcor continues, he participates in the vengeance of the judgment of God. Here we find, though with some modification, taken up Psalm 82:1 and Isaiah 61:2. Melchizedek is thus apparently identified with Michael, who also appears in Qumran as a celestial being in the War Scroll 1QM. In fact, Melchizedek is helped by the celestial armies in his struggle against Belial and his angels. We will see later the interest of these speculations on the person of Melchizedek as a celestial being for a better understanding of the Epistle to the Hebrews. As the scriptures speak neither of the birth nor the death of this person, Melchizedek, it is easy to imagine him to be eternal and therefore that this priest should be present in the heavens. The author of the Qumran fragment did not hesitate to indulge in these speculations. Now, Davila writes this, the theme of the eschatological war in heaven between the angelic forces of good and the demonic forces of evil was a topic of great interest in early Jewish and Christian literature. The focus of this paper is the reflexes of this story, which named Michael or Melchizedek as the leader of the heavenly army. Skipping ahead to the next paragraph, when a leader of the battling angels is mentioned in these texts, he is almost always either Michael or Melchizedek. It seems clear that the two were identified, at least in some circles. In Qumran sectarian literature, each appears as the head of the angelic hosts at the eschatological battle in different texts. Based on this fact, as well as contextual considerations, Millick suggested that a fragmentary passage in the Visions of Amram, 4Q544, originally listed them together as names of the Angel of Light. So that's, I'll just break in there. There's this character in this text, the Angel of Light, and what Davila is saying is these might be named, Michael and Melchizedek might be names for that particular angel, again, because the texts have related content. Now, let's go down a little bit to... Okay, another third paragraph for Davila. The relationship of these two angels, Michael and Melchizedek, or Michael and the Angel of Light, again, it's not really clear what Davila is referring to there. It's the prose is a little bit obscure. But the relationship of these two angels and how they came to be associated with one another, he's probably referring to Melchizedek here, even though Melchizedek's not an angel, but maybe he's saying an angel in this text anyway. But their relationship is one of the issues to be considered in this study. And he spends a lot of time trying to explicate this. Moving on, he says, the narrative of column 2, which we just read, describes the eschatological conflict fought by the divine being Melchizedek and his angelic allies against Belial and the evil spirits of his lot. And then Davila goes on to compare the language of 11Q Melchizedek with the War Scroll and some other things where Michael is the picture. So basically what his article is going to be about, at least in this section, is how Michael and Melchizedek sort of play the same role, and they're in this battle that's described the same way in various texts from the Dead Sea Scrolls. Now, this is me now. We're done with the quotations. I don't believe that Michael was the second power. In other words, was the second Yahweh figure. Or I don't believe that Michael is the angel of the Lord. Now, some do. Seventh-day Adventists in particular, you know, take that position. They're not the only ones, but they certainly take it. I think the idea is contradicted, actually, by two places in Daniel. And that's kind of material for another episode, but just so that you know, I don't think Michael is the angel of the Lord. I think there's problems with that. The point for our purposes here are that some Jews made that equation. Okay, some Jews thought that. Now, I think personally that this thinking, okay, is tied to the second power in heaven, second Yahweh figure. And we have here an exalted angel, again, cast as the second power in heaven. And the most obvious candidate is Michael. But some Jews, again, thought this was Melchizedek exalted to some sort of heavenly state. You know, he becomes glorified or something like that. Now, Michael is Israel's prince. Melchizedek was a priest king. Now, I think in part, the way they're sort of thought about together is because the captain of the Lord's host, remember Joshua 5, the captain of the Lord's host is clearly divine. Okay, this is, if you remember Joshua 5, you know, Joshua encounters the captain of the commander of the Lord's host, and he says, you know, what side are you, you know, who are you, dude? You know, what side are you on? He says, I'm the commander of the Lord's host. And then he says, hey, you know, the place where you're standing is holy ground. Take off your sandals. It's the same language that you get in Exodus 3 with the burning bush. Exactly the same. So, you know, the commander of the Lord's host is a divine being. And since we have this connection back to Exodus 3, I think he's the angel of the Lord. I think he's the angel of the Lord for a different reason. And I discuss all of this in Unseen Realm, because the description of the commander of the Lord's army there in Joshua 5 describes the commander there as having a drawn sword in his hand. Okay. The Hebrew phrase for that, exactly, the exact Hebrew phrase, occurs only two other times in the Hebrew Bible. One is in 1 Chronicles 20, 16. The other one is in Numbers 22. I think it's verse 24. But they both explicitly in those two other passages say that the person with the drawn sword in his hand is the angel of the Lord. So I think there's a really, really powerful case here to identify the commander of Yahweh's host in Joshua 5 as the Malach Adonai, as the angel of the Lord. Now, you know, if that's the case, well, it kind of makes sense, at least to some Jews, that to think of that figure, the angel of the Lord, as Michael, because he's the commander of Yahweh's armies on behalf of Israel, and Michael is called Israel's prince. So they sort of conflate those two things. That's how people argue that Michael is the angel of the Lord. Again, I think there's problems with that when you get into some passages in Daniel. But nevertheless, I just want you to know how would you get there, you know, how the thinking would go. They also, again, if you're the prince of Israel, well, that sounds, you know, kind of messianic. That's like kind of Messiah talk, prince of Israel, you know. And so once you go there, then you do start thinking about Melchizedek. Why? Because Melchizedek, you know, the Davidic king in Psalm 110 is declared to be, you know, after the order of Melchizedek. And so this is how, if you're a Jew, you could justify thinking, okay, angel of the Lord, Michael, Melchizedek, they're all the same guy. This is how you would get there. This is how you would argue that. And of course, the Messiah is your leader at the great eschatological battle. I mean, who else would it be? So you have these ideas that are very, I think pretty easy to see how Jews would have conflated all of these things into one figure. And so when you have Jews writing in the Second Temple period, you have some of them use Melchizedek, some of them use Michael. You know, you got that one that says angel of light, you know, like, you know, maybe he's just the oddball out here. But everybody else is talking about Melchizedek or Michael. And if you're thinking of that figure in those terms, again, tying it back to Joshua 5, being the guy in charge of Yahweh's armies, well, you know, then you could look at Psalm 82 and say, well, look, what's being described here in Psalm 82, judgment of the nations, you know, and a Jew would look at that. And again, this particular Jew who wrote 11Q Melchizedek associates the reclaiming of the nations in a final eschatological sense and the death of the gods in a final sense, with the release of the captives. You know, Israel is released from exile. You know, the separation from God is over. You know, our captivity is over. You know, we're forgiven, and the Messiah is here. Again, you have to get rid of the New Testament in your head. None of that's happened yet, and so this is your vision as a Jew of what's going to happen when the Messiah returns. Of course, you know, we're going to be liberated. You know, everything's going to be set right. It's the day of the Lord, you know, kind of thinking. They're not thinking about you know, oh, he's going to come, he's going to go and die on a cross, he's going to rise again. Remember, again, we've discussed this at length in Unseen Realm and at length on this podcast, how the plan of redemption was cryptic. They weren't supposed to know. What they're thinking is messianic deliverance, the restoration of the kingdom. And quite frankly, that's what the powers of darkness are thinking too, because it's like, well, he's back here. The Son of the Most High is back here to reclaim his turf, and this silly talk about restoring Eden. Well, this is our turf now. We're going to kill the guy. I mean, this is what they were expecting. This is what they knew. The redemptive sort of aspect to it, the salvific sort of aspect, that is fragmented in lots of places. It's never spelled out, and they miss it. And here you have Second Temple texts that are tracking, you know, along the militaristic theme. And if you're doing that, and you see, again, going back to Joshua 5, here you have the commander of the Lord's host, obviously divine being. Well, that, you know, Michael's the prince, so these two guys must be the same. And who else would lead the battle in the last day but the Messiah? So Michael and this guy must be the Messiah as well. And hey, if it's the Messiah, we got to bring Melchizedek into the question, because the Messiah, the son of David, in Psalm 110, is a priest forever after the order of Melchizedek. So you can put all these things together, and that's what they do. They don't have any of the stuff that is probably, you know, lurking around in our heads about the New Testament, because we're not even at the New Testament yet. This is pre-Jesus stuff in the Second Temple period. But this is how you get the portrait that a guy, you know, who's writing in second or in 11Q Melchizedek, this is how he would get there. Now, from Reversing Hermon, I want to read a little bit that relates to this, again, just to bring that material into this discussion. This is from chapter 10. Again, this is talking about how another element to getting to this portrait is to focus on who the enemy is. Again, the Belial figure and the bad guys on the other side of the apocalyptic war. Again, what I'm doing here is I'm just fleshing out for you how a Jew would have been thinking about this material and how they get to this profile where Michael, Melchizedek, Messiah, they're all the same guy and they're fighting, you know, the sons of Belial and you know, the big bad guy on the other side and all that. So here's another element to it from Reversing Hermon, chapter 10. In a pseudepigraphical work known as The Assumption of Moses, a work whose content shows up in the New Testament book of Jude, we read the following passage. This is chapter 8, verses 1 through 3. Actually, I'm just going to give you one. And there will come upon them punishment and wrath, such as never happened to them from the creation till the time when he stirs up against them a king of the kings of the earth, who, having supreme authority, will crucify those who confess their circumcision. And the interesting line here is the reference to, quote, a king of the kings of the earth. The writer is clearly citing Psalm 2, verse 2, which is a messianic psalm about how the kings of the nations will rise up against the Messiah. And he transforms the verse to point to a great leader of those kings. So Psalm 2:2 talks about the Gentiles rising up, you know, against the Messiah. But the writer of the Assumption of Moses turns that phrase into a king of the kings of the earth. So you have a great end times enemy that's in view in the Assumption of Moses here. Now, Horbury, who's a New Testament scholar, writes, Jewish sources from the end of the Second Temple period, which describe an Antichrist-like figure without using the term, name him rather as the Wicked One, or Gog, or Beliar. These sources can be said to bridge the gap between the biblical passages already noted, which attest to the expectations of a messianic victory and of a final arch enemy of Israel. Horbury's point, this is me now, is that while a developed doctrine of Antichrist is indeed of Christian origin, the component of that Christian teaching that had the Antichrist as an imperial tyrant bent on opposing the rule of Messiah is pre-Christian and of Jewish origin. Horbury's reference to the Wicked One, Gog or Beliar, brings us to a third background element. Again, this is chapter 10 in Reversing Hermon, so I'm referring to something earlier. Brings us to another element for our discussion of the beast, the Antichrist. Belial, also spelled Beliar in some Dead Sea Scrolls, is the leader of the powers of darkness. Okay, that's pretty obvious. Now, I quote a fellow named here, Torleif Elgvin or Elgvin, and he summarizes how, you know, how this works, the great, you know, end times enemy, how this works in Jewish expectation. He writes, The New Testament concepts of Satan and his host are closely related to ideas that develop in intertestamental period and are found in early Jewish literature. In their interpretation of Old Testament passages, various books among the pseudepigrapha and Qumran literature give different explanations to the presence of evil in the world. Some writings describe the struggle between good and evil as a cosmic spiritual struggle and anticipate the ultimate annihilation of evil and the evil powers. In some texts, the evil powers have an angelic leader named Shemhaza, or Mastema, or Belial, or the Prince of Darkness. The earliest post-biblical source that elaborates on evil angelic forces is probably the Enochic Book of the Watchers, 1 Enoch 6-16. These chapters interpret Genesis 6:1 5. The angelic watchers cohabit with earthly women and bring magic, sin, and violence to the earth. Enoch is shown the coming judgment on the angels, who in vain ask him to intercede for them. Their leader is Shemhaza, but he is not portrayed as a cosmic opponent to God or the elect. Again, in that text, but later on, again, he will be. People will take that name and apply it to the great end times enemy who will oppose and confront and battle with the Messiah. Now, Eldrin's view of the data, overview of the data, shows that for Second Temple period Jewish theology, the leader of the Watchers went by various names, Shemhaza, Mastema, Belial, the Prince of Darkness, and the last title has obvious overlap with the way New Testament's rites of Satan. So this is how, again, on the flip side, this is how Jews were thinking. This is why you have this final war described the way it is. When you see in these texts, Belial, Beliar, Mastema, Shemhaza, these are all in the mind of certain Jewish writers. They're all sort of other words for Satan. And so naturally, at the end of days, his opponent will be the Messiah. And, you have this messianic profile that has Messiah as a warrior. Well, that's the captain of the Lord's host in Joshua 5. And he's a son of David. That brings Melchizedek into the equation because of Psalm 110. And, of course, Michael is the prince of Israel. So it must be all the same guy. I mean, this is how you get the end times eschatology, or at least the apocalyptic battle, who the characters are and what's happening and why. This is how you get there in Second Temple Jewish thinking. Now, again, I'm not going to take all those positions. Again, I think there's a problem with the Michael-Melchizedek equation, Michael as the angel of the Lord, and so on and so forth. And we'll hit that at another time. Probably when we hit the New Testament, maybe I'll bring some of that in, or we'll do an episode of its own on that. But if we go back to 11Q Melchizedek with all this thing, we've got the good guy, it goes by various names. We got the bad guy, goes by various names. And in 11Q Melchizedek, the good guy, the leader, the chief combatant, the Elohim of Psalm 82 is Melchizedek, who is also, for Second Temple Jews, the angel of the Lord, who is also Michael. Again, this is how they're thinking when they get to that passage. Now, 11Q Melchizedek brings other passages into the profile. The Jubilee chronology is a big deal. You've got Isaiah 52, Isaiah 61. And that is connected, of course, with the Day of Atonement, because the Day of Atonement comes after, again, the end of the Jubilee cycle, and so on and so forth. So that's interesting, obviously, and I've already alluded to it, because of what happens in Luke 4. Isn't it odd, or isn't it interesting? Isn't it fascinating that when Jesus starts his ministry, he's there in Nazareth, he goes into the synagogue, and he takes the scroll from Isaiah, Isaiah 61, and I'm going to go there. And a lot of you will know this, but I think it's just more effective if I actually, sort of read it, and you get to hear what's left out. But he goes to the synagogue there in Luke chapter 4, and this is what we read here. He says, at verse 17, we'll go back to verse 17, "The scroll of the prophet Isaiah was given to him. He unrolled the scroll and found the place where it was written." I mean, he's doing this intentionally. He found the place where it was written. "The Spirit of the Lord is upon me, because he has anointed me to proclaim good news to the poor. He has sent me to proclaim liberty to the captives and recovering of sight to the blind, to set at liberty those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." And he rolled up the scroll and gave it back to the attendant and sat down. And the eyes of all in the synagogue were fixed on him. And he began to say to them, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." You know, and he gets a mixed reaction. But he says, "Today, this scripture has been fulfilled in your hearing." Well, look at this. He references the poor. He references the captives. He references the oppressed. Now, he's quoting Isaiah 61, but some of those terms are in Psalm 82. The writer of 11Q Melchizedek understood that. They knew that. I think Jesus knew it too, because, you know, later when we get to the episode in John, he's going to quote Psalm 82. You know, I don't want to rabbit trail back into that, but here's the point. Isn't it kind of fascinating that Jesus chooses this passage? And if you're familiar with Isaiah 61, you know, he stops, you know, with "set at liberty, you know, those who are oppressed, to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor." What he leaves out, okay, the next line in Isaiah 61, right after "to proclaim the year of the Lord's favor," which is where Jesus stops, the next line is, "and the day of vengeance of our God, to comfort all who mourn, to grant to those who mourn in Zion, to give them a beautiful headdress instead of ashes," and so on and so forth. But he leaves out the day of the Lord line. Why? Well, it's kind of obvious. He knows why he's there. And it is not for conquest. He's there to die. But that's what they don't know. So if you're comparing what Jesus does, let's just imagine that you've got a few people there in Nazareth that day who have read 11Q Melchizedek, or they think of the same thing. They're expecting, by virtue of that text and the quotation of Isaiah 61, they're expecting a deliverer. They're expecting military conquest. They're expecting the final battle, because that's just the picture. That's the picture that's in their head. And here you have this guy from Nazareth show up in your synagogue, and he says, today, this is fulfilled, you know, in your hearing. And then, you know, what's he going to do? He's going to go out from that point and start doing those things. He's going to heal people. He's going to preach the gospel. He's going to talk about the kingdom of God, you know, all this kind of stuff. And eventually he's going to die and provide redemption and atonement, which is associated with the Jubilee cycle, is it not? You know, that you just look at that picture, and he's both, you both get a holy cow moment, you know, out of people in the room there in Nazareth. And you'd also get, why did he stop there? Doesn't he know the scripture? Or maybe he's a pretender. You know, he's not going to deliver us. You know, you get all these sort of thought patterns going. Now, when we I'm going to end on this note, because, you know, we are drifting in the New Testament territory now. I think we've said enough about how conceptually you could go from Melchizedek of the Old Testament and come out thinking of him as a divine being because of, again, this matrix of ideas. And here you have a classic example in 11Q Melchizedek of Jews doing this very thing. And how they get there. I think we've said enough about that. But back when we did Ezekiel 40 to 48, part two, you know, when we talked about New Testament temple talk associating with the body of the Messiah, Jesus' body was the temple, his followers are the temple, the church is the temple, you know, basically arguing in favor of a more than literal approach. Because in the first part, we did two episodes on Ezekiel 40 through 48. The first part, we talked about the problems that a literal approach brings. But fundamentally, a literal approach ignores over 60 references to Jubilee language, Jubilee concepts, and other concepts that have to do with, you know, cosmic geography and, you know, associated ideas in those chapters, that you can look to the New Testament and you can see how those things play out, again, abstractly. Somebody emailed me after we did that and asked this question. They asked, "Hey, is there any, you know, this all this Jubilee stuff, you know, was the day of Jesus' birth, that September 11th, 3 BC thing, was the day of Jesus' birth a Jubilee year?" I went and asked Mantello, again, my astronomer, and he said, you know, no, it wasn't a Jubilee year. But he gave me the math on how to calculate from that date when the Jubilee year fell. And believe it or not, the Jubilee year fell in the year that Jesus began his ministry in the synagogue at Nazareth when he quotes Isaiah 61, which was really stunning. Again, if you're tracking on, if you're a Jew, I mean, and obviously not every Jew is going to be tracking all this stuff, but if you're an educated, literate Jew, you know, and maybe you've heard the birth traditions or something like that. But certainly if you're, you know, if you're toward the end of the first century where you have, you know, that, this information and you can look back on, you know, you're going to have a couple of the Gospels written there, maybe all of them, I guess all of them by that time. And you have this episode in the synagogue and you have this citation of Isaiah 1 and you know the Jewish tradition about the Messiah and you, you know, you know what Jesus did and all this sort of stuff. That kind of thing is really remarkable. You know, that it shows Jesus in all the good sense of the word. Jesus is so calculated. He walks into that synagogue in the Jubilee year and he you know, he takes the scroll and he finds the place. He finds Isaiah 61 and he quotes it, but he doesn't include the day of the Lord stuff. And he just rolls it back up and hands it off, sits down, says, "Today, you know, today all this stuff is fulfilled in your hearing." And he knows the range of reactions that's going to draw, in part because of the way people thought about not only Messiah, but Melchizedek. And later on, when whoever wrote the book of Hebrews, when he connects Jesus to Melchizedek, this is all part of a consistent picture. This is not novel when it comes to Jewish thinking. Jews were mentally there. The book of Hebrews is written to a Jewish audience. Okay, they understand because they have these categories in their thinking already. And you know, when you can show what Jesus did theologically, you know, what the result of the crucifixion was, and you can show how, again, in hindsight, how the chronology of his life was intentional in certain ways. You know, we're given certain pieces of information, like the birth. You know, I talk about this in Reversing Hermann, like the genealogy. You know, we've got all this material out at this point. When whoever writes Hebrews and writes to that audience, a Jewish audience, you know, who are either struggling with, you know, their acceptance of Jesus as the Messiah, they're, you know, teetering on the edge of doing that, and they're under persecution and all this stuff. These are not random things that the writers pull out because they don't know what else to put on, you know, on the piece of papyrus or, you know, the animal skin. They're building an intelligent profile that shows what Jesus did with intention, how God had this planned, how Jesus acted according to plan, and how it's consistent with their own reading, in many cases, of the Old Testament. It's not novel. The only thing missing for you people is who the second power really was. You have all of the boxes to put these things in. You've got all the file drawers. You understand the concepts. But it wasn't some other guy. It was this guy. It was Jesus of Nazareth who did these things. Here's the playing out of his life chronologically, historically, and here are the theological concepts. Again, the file drawers that you've already got open in your head. You need to believe. In the case of the book of Hebrews, you need to not forsake, you know, the faith. You need to not surrender your belief. You need to not drift back into unbelief. And so, again, there's just a lot of intentionality going on here. I'm going to stop here because we will pick up some of the thoughts again in our next episode. We focus on the New Testament. We get into the book of Hebrews. But again, the purpose of this episode is to help you to see how, again, what the New Testament says, you know, what you've been taught, what you've heard probably at some point in preaching, it's not a contrivance. Jews thought these ways about this person, Melchizedek. And hopefully it makes sense to you now how they could get there, how it would make sense to think this way, how they, you know, what dots they would connect to wind up where they did. And again, it works if there's legitimately a second power in heaven who fits this profile. And there was. And that's what we'll get into next time.
More pieces to the puzzle, Mike.
Yeah. Yeah. More dots, more pieces. More points of the mosaic, whatever metaphor helps.
Absolutely.
or hurts less.
Well, maybe you answered some people's questions out there. And just a quick reminder, don't forget to be gathering your thoughts, because after part three airs, you'll have about a week to send me any questions you have, because we're going to do an entire Q&A dedicated to your questions about the subject matter, Melchizedek. So, and also, go vote for the next book that we're going to cover, Mike. The poll is live as we speak. I just sit there and hit refresh just to see what the status is.
I shouldn't laugh. I mean, I'll do that a couple times too. You know, it's...
I hear you. All right, Mike. Well, next week we're going to take a break from Melchizedek, and we got an interview lined up. You want to tell us?
Yeah, we have the authors. There's two of them of the book "Surviving and Thriving in Seminary: An Academic and Spiritual Handbook." Now, I know the authors, Danny Zacharias and Benjamin Forrest. We're not doing this book because I think everybody who listens to the podcast is going to run out and take a seminary class. We're doing this book because I really like the way it sort of offers really good advice on how to be a good student. And secondarily, again, not because it's less important, just number two thought here, how to, again, not maintain your faith while you've got your head in all this academic stuff, even though there's an aspect to that, but just how to be thinking in terms of application. You know, both Danny and Benjamin, you know, have again a mind to serve the layperson with content. This is why we pick the things we do on this podcast. We are interested in promoting the work and the effort, rewarding the effort of people who try to help, you know, all of you out there in the audience, be good students of Scripture, and then transmit that to somebody else. You know, apply it to your own life and help people apply it to their life. So this is a nice little handbook. Yeah, it's got seminary in the title, but don't be put off by that. They just have good advice, you know, in both those areas.
All right, sounds good, Mike. Looking forward to that. And after that, don't forget Melchizedek Part 3 coming your way. So again, I just want to thank everybody for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. God bless.
Thanks for listening to the Naked Bible Podcast. To support this podcast, visit www.nakedbibleblog.com. To learn more about Dr. Heiser's other websites and blogs, go to www.drmsh.com.